right, welcome to the Interpreter Show. This week, I am your host, Neil Rapley, and I am joined here in studio with Jasmine Rapley and Stephen Smoot. And we have joining us by phone, Hales Swift. All right, excellent. Where should we begin today? Maybe the devotional that is just wrapping up or just wrapped up with Elder Carl B. Cook?
Carl B., yep. Carl B. and Lynette Cook.
Oh, different Cook.
Yeah, it was not Elder Quentin L. Cook.
That's who I was expecting. Because that was, because I just heard, oh, Elder Cook is speaking tonight. Elder Cook, oh, great, you know, an apostle speaking. Oh, nope, turns out it's Carl B. Cook.
That's how they get you.
Exactly.
All right, so, Stephen, why don't you maybe give us a quick rundown on the devotional and what Carl Cook talked about, Elder Cook talked about.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So he was speaking to an audience of young single adults. Well, actually, just young adults, rather. I don't think they're necessarily single adults. Although there were a number of single adults in the audience, and the topic, as is wont to be the topic in a for an audience like this, was on marriage, and specifically the importance of eternal marriage, how to build and progress towards an eternal marriage, and that included a discussion of some of the underlying Latter-day Saint doctrinal views on eternal marriage, as well as some advice or counsel on practical application for how to achieve an eternal marriage and how to foster an eternal marriage. So, in a nutshell, it was about getting married. And as the only single adult here on the broadcast, it was duly noted, and I felt appropriately rebuked.
Stephen, what are you doing about this problem?
Yeah, that's right.
You're going on the radio to talk about really nerdy stuff. That's
exactly
definitely
yeah.
helping.
Well, nobody tell the cook, but I had a date tonight and I canceled for the show. Right?
Oh man.
No, that's not true. That's a joke. No, I'm totally joking.
I was going to say you should have brought the date here.
Been a double.
Like, there's no way to test a good date like throwing her into the fire on the radio, right?
Exactly. Hey, honey, want to come and discuss Mormon apologetics on the radio with me? It'll be awesome. We'll have a great time.
I mean, it works for Neil and Jasmine, right?
That's right. We started this radio show not married.
Yeah. And here we are. Look how far we've come. We've been married how many months now? 9 months?
Ten months?
Wow.
Now, what most people probably don't realize is that before Jasmine even started joining the show, she was actually sitting out in the foyer because I was bringing her up to dinner with my parents, which at the time was just down the street from the studio, but we've relocated the studio since then. But I was bringing her up for dinner with my parents, and then we were going to the radio show right after, and she was just waiting in the foyer. And then it was Martin who made her get on the radio.
It's true. I've regretted it ever since. But it's got a marriage out of it, so things are pretty good, you know, on the topic of eternal marriage. Some things that Elder Cook talked about that was really sweet. First of all, gotta love the cuteness factor of his video that he shared, where he had a little slideshow of all of the apostles and their wives when they first got married and kind of a before and after shot of them now. And just talking about, you know, why they love their wives. It was super adorable. And it's fun to think of these apostles that we've come to view as sage-like and wise and old, to remember that they were once humans and that were our age and had many foibles and I'm sure had many failed dating attempts before finding their eternal companion. So that was really a little bit tender. One thing that I liked was towards the end of his devotional, he compared eternal marriage to building Nephi's ship. He brought in the Book of Mormon and how Nephi didn't know what to do. He had never built a ship before, and it was a monumental task that's seemingly impossible to do in the Arabian Desert, and yet he put his trust in the Lord, and with the Lord's help, he was able to do all things that the Lord commanded him to do. And that eternal marriage is kind of like a giant ship, too. Not just finding your eternal companion and putting faith in the Lord that one day that might happen for you, even if it's feeling impossible. But once you are married as well, that constant building of the relationship is very akin to building a boat. And, you know, plank by plank and nail by nail, you're building experiences together and overcoming a lot of obstacles in the meantime, and it takes a lot of faith to do, but hopefully we come out on the other side and have a beautiful journey behind us. And, of course, Neil and I are just barely starting our journey. But I appreciate the reminders of the importance of eternal marriage that he impressed.
Absolutely, yes.
Stephen, if you don't mind my asking, as a single person, what were your impressions of the message? Did you find it encouraging, discouraging? Did he deliver a message that you think will resonate with a lot of single adults? Or was it something that, you know, did you feel any disconnects there?
Well, I have to be honest for just a moment when I say that when a general authority, as well-intentioned as I know they are, when an older general authority gives a fireside or devotional on marriage, a part of me just kind of cringes because there's been some times where they meant well with their message, but they may say some things that aren't necessarily helpful or may sort of cause some tension or alienation. However, I did not get any of that sense at all in this devotional. I was quite pleased and quite enlightened and edified by what I heard. There was no, for me, the biggest factor is whether or not the speaker is sort of condescending to the lowly single folk, right? Whether they're sort of, and not that necessarily many have done that, but rather just a sense of, are they talking down to us versus are they the sort of getting in there with us? And Elder Cook at many points said, and Lynette and I myself, in my experience, and it wasn't sort of him putting himself up on a pedestal, sort of lecturing us single folk for our failures. It was rather a genuine, sincere, and thoughtful counsel and help on this. So overall, I was very impressed. I thought it was a very nice devotional. It was punctuated with nice little bits of humor here and there. I thought that overall it was also very spiritually edifying. So I was very impressed. And I think that he had some very sound advice for single Latter-day Saint young adults that I think will be helpful towards achieving eternal marriage.
I agree. And it's kind of a tale as old as time thing. I mean, it's not just our generation who often feel lectured by the older generation, but, you know, every generation before us getting lectured about marriage by the old guys can feel disingenuous or can feel like, well, you don't know what dating is like today. But I felt like his message was really well-tempered and really good. And, you know, in a church where the single young adults are a growing contingency and people are getting married later in life, and sometimes not at all. And, of course, this also intersects a little bit with the church's relationship with LGBTQ issues. It can be a pretty daunting thing to decide to speak on eternal marriage
in this
climate. And so I do admire his bravery in still staking out important eternal truths.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. I'm sure Jana Reese's recent book, The Next Mormons, has been discussed here. I know we've mentioned a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I understand that some have critiqued some of her methodology and conclusions she's drawn. But one thing that she did add that I think is valuable is showing that single millennial Latter-day Saints are more likely to go inactive or leave the church than married millennial Latter-day Saints. It's a factor of like 2-1 almost. It's some very high number of, if you're going through your 20s and 30s as a single Latter-day Saint, odds are you're probably going to leave the church if you don't have a proper emotional and spiritual support. And I felt that Elder Cook was sort of addressing that, but not in a direct, like a sermonizing lecture kind of way, but just genuinely wanting to help single millennial Latter-day Saints navigate what is becoming an increasingly fraught sort of minefield in today's culture. Jasmine mentioned LGBT issues, but you have issues of technology, which Elder Cook brought up, how technology is factoring into marriage and dating and that sort of thing.
Oh, for sure.
Overall, like I said, I thought it was very helpful.
Excellent. Before we move on, maybe one thing to keep in mind is after you do get married and have begun that eternal journey, what do? You go on a honeymoon. And for a honeymoon, you might want to go on a getaway with Cruise Lady.
That was smooth as butter, Neil. Nicely done.
So we're just going to – Cruise Lady is one of our sponsors here on the Interpreter Show, and we've just got a brief message to read from them real quick. Have you dreamed of a trip to the Holy Land or to Book of Mormon lands? Now is the time. Experience an unforgettable, relaxing getaway on a cruise ship or an escorted land tour with Cruise Lady. The best in tours for Latter-day Saints. For example, join a Cruise Lady cruise featuring likely Book of Mormon lands starting at $569 with Professor Jack Welch in December this year. or join a tour to the Holy Land this May. That's maybe right now, I don't know. With Interpreter's Own Professor Dan Peterson as your guide, or let Professor Robert Millett guide your tour of church history sites this September. For details, you can contact Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. That's 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. All right, so I think we are ready to move on from Elder Cook's devotional, wonderful message. And for those, we know we have a massive contingent of young single adults listening to this radio show on a Sunday evening. Yes. So for those of you out there, go get married and then go on a cruise with Cruise Lady. But I actually thought we should maybe move on to the, you know, this is the Interpreter Show, and Interpreter, for those who don't know, is primarily it's a nonprofit foundation that sponsors scholarship and research on Latter-day Saint faith and things like that, and it's its primary outlet for that kind of activity is a journal, which publishes a paper once a week online, makes those papers accessible for free. And this week's paper was particularly interesting, and I thought might be worth having a little chat about, by Bruce E. Dale and Brian Dale, a pair of brothers. The title of the paper is Joseph Smith, The World's Greatest Guesser, a Bayesian Statistical Analysis of Positive and Negative Correspondences Between the Book of Mormon and the Maya. But it's important to note that the Maya in this title here is actually referring to the book The Maya by Michael Coe, not specifically the Maya civilization, though obviously the book is on the Maya civilization. I don't know statistics super well, but I was hoping maybe Hales had a chance to look at this paper. Because
I did, as it turns out.
Excellent, because he's much mathier than I am. I don't know if it's a word.
Clearly, Neil's very qualified to be discussing this paper.
I am very qualified. I took intro to statistics. I can't even say the word. I took, I did classes once. They're taking... they're kind of going at Michael Coe directly. They point out that Michael Coe has been very critical of the Book of Mormon in the past, and he's not aware of any evidence for it or whatever. And so basically they said, okay, well, let's take Michael Coe's own publication, the Maya. They're using the most recent edition, at least the most recent edition I'm aware of, the ninth edition, which is actually also co-authored with Stephen Houston, and was published in 2015. It's just a summary of Maya civilization and history. And they are just taking every fact in there and comparing it to the data we get about Nephite civilization in the Book of Mormon. And they come out with a list of something like 131 correspondences between what the way Coe describes the Maya and what the Book of Mormon says. And they do some kind of probability analysis to determine how likely it is that all of those correspondences would have emerged by coincidence. And so that's kind of the gist of the paper. It looks like we're actually going to go to a commercial break in about 30 seconds. So maybe when we get back, we'll have – I would be very interested to hear what Hales thinks about their analysis.
Okay.
All right. This has been the Interpreter Show, and we will be right back. Welcome back to the Interpreter Show. I am Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley and Stephen Smoot. And joining us by phone is Hales Swift. Just before the break, as I mentioned, we are talking about the latest paper published in the Interpreter Foundation Journal on the statistical likelihood of Joseph Smith writing the Book of Mormon in a way that has quite a bit of correspondence with Michael Coe's work on the Maya. And it's a pretty bold conclusion that they come to. It's they're really kind of coming out swinging a little bit. Hales, what were your thoughts on this paper?
So the gist of what they're doing probabilistically is they're saying If I recall right, the probability of him getting certain things right, given what the milieu was at his time, what people thought was the case,
uh-huh.
And they're looking at a number of particular events, but for everything he gets right, they're assigning an incremental, or they're saying he has maybe only 50% chance of getting it right, whereas if anything that's wrong, they're counting against him quite a bit, or not in accord with current knowledge. And what they do is they show that if you take all of these things into account, you get a very high probability of him having actual information. And it's a pretty strong argument because, sure, you can guess a few things right. People get stuff right occasionally. People guess which team is going to win a game by flipping a coin about half the time. But if you're able to get a large body of things right and have a relatively low number of discrepancies, which are in many cases even actually indeterminate, it's just a matter of we haven't found them yet,
mm-hmm.
Then there's a very strong case can be made that you are working with actual information, actual sources that that are telling you something about what the world was like, say, when the Book of Mormon presents itself as having been written. So, pretty neat.
Yeah.
I hope that wasn't too convoluted.
No, I don't think it was too convoluted, and I'm trying to find maybe a good summation within the paper itself. I guess maybe the best way to go would just maybe read the abstract to people so that they get a little bit
yeah.
more of an idea of exactly what we're talking about. But what they said is Dr. Michael Coe is a prominent Mesoamerican scholar and author of a synthesis and review of ancient Mesoamerican Indian cultures entitled The Maya. Dr. Coe is also a prominent skeptic of the Book of Mormon. However, there is in his book strong evidence that favors the Book of Mormon, which Dr. Coe has not taken into account. This article analyzes that evidence using Bayesian statistics. And maybe it might be helpful to explain exactly what Bayesian statistics is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Bayes' theorem briefly gives you the probability of something being true given another fact that you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you could say the probability of the Book of Mormon being an ancient work given some fact you know about it. But it's generally can be expressed as a formula, which is the probability of A given B is equal to the probability of B given A times the probability of A divided by the probability of B. Which sounds like a little bit of a mouthful because there's lots of B's in it. But the gist of it is if you know how likely the event is to occur that is in the, say, how likely some particular feature is to be in the book, you can then multiply that by the probability of Joseph getting that feature right given that it's an ancient I'm not sure I can like say this right on the radio, so I'm just going to stop.
It
takes a lot of very careful thought to actually make this sentence correct, so
sure,
I'm going to stop.
I, having read and tried to read many statistical reasoning sorts of publications in my own lifetime, I can appreciate how difficult it is to distill that down in a way that is understandable for the layman. But continuing on with their abstract, they say, we apply a strongly skeptical prior assumption that the Book of Mormon has little to do with early Indian cultures, as Dr. Coe claims. We then compare 131 separate positive correspondences or points of evidence between the Book of Mormon and Dr. Koh's book. We also analyzed negative points of evidence between the Book of Mormon and the Maya, between the Book of Mormon and a 1973 dialogue article written by Dr. Koh, and between the Book of Mormon and a series of Mormon Stories podcast interviews given by Dr. Koh to Dr. John DeLynn. After using the Bayesian methodology to analyze both positive and negative correspondences, we reach an enormously stronger and very positive conclusion. There is overwhelming evidence that the Book of Mormon has physical, political, geographical, religious, military, technological, and cultural roots in ancient Mesoamerica. As a control, we have also analyzed two other books dealing with ancient American Indians' view of the Hebrews and manuscript found. We compare both books with the Maya using the same statistical methodology and demonstrate that this methodology leads to rational conclusions about whether or not such books describe peoples and places similar to those described in the Maya. So to summarize, when they say they are starting with a strong skeptical prior conclusion, they explain more in the paper that basically they set the math up so that before you look at any of the evidence, the default assumption is that it's false, and the likelihood that it's true is 1 billion to 1, right? Or 1 in 1 billion odds that it could possibly be true before you've even looked at the evidence. So they're setting it up in a way that the Book of Mormon has a lot of ground to make up for before the analysis.
Once you look at how much of the facts turn out, you find out it actually does that well.
Yeah, and then basically when you get to the end, they're basically explaining that after starting with this idea that it's a 1 in 1 billion chance that it's not true, they end up with you add up the probability of all 131 correspondences.
There are 1 in 1 billion chance that it is true, right?
No.
Technically you're multiplying.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah.
1 in 1 billion chance that it is true, and then they start adding up the probabilities with each of the 131, and the odds completely flip, and it becomes they can't even express the number in terms that you can really wrap your head around. But it ends up being like 1 in billions upon billions upon billions that it is not true, actually. The likelihood of all of those things adding up. Did I get that right, Hales?
That's the gist of it. Yeah. Except if you multiply the probabilities rather than adding them.
Right.
I
didn't mean add in a technical sense,
okay.
I suppose. But that's okay. You're right. You're multiplying probabilities as you combine them. When you have two things that are 50% likely, the odds that both happen is only 25% likely, and
exactly.
And so it goes. So they do a couple of things. I can't comment a lot on the statistics, but I did look over their list of correspondences a little bit, there's a lot of really interesting things in here. One thing I do wish that they had maybe done is that they had had a couple of additional co-authors working with them who had more familiarity with the ancient American material evidence, and also maybe another author who had more familiarity with the 19th century setting of the Book of Mormon, who could have weighed in on the strength of specific correspondences, because I'm not always 100% on board, but they did a couple things in their methodological analysis to try to kind of account for that.
Didn't they limit my recollection is that they limited the improvement to factors of two, right? So they basically only said any of these things, he only gets a 50% advantage for getting them right.
Yeah.
Anything that was wrong, they had a much larger penalty.
So the way they did it is they actually had a three-tiered strength of evidence system,
okay.
Where the most general type of evidence or correspondence, they considered a 50-50. They then had some that they thought were more specific that they gave him a 10% chance of guessing right, and then some that were really specific that they weighted as a 2% chance of guessing right. But what they actually do to try and account, they do this sensitivity analysis to try and account for any sort of bias on their own part. And one of the things they do in the sensitivity analysis is they reduce, they go back to basically a 50-50 chance for all 131.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what it was.
And yeah, I think that's what you're thinking of. And basically, even when you give it the highest probability that he could have just guessed any of these right, you still end up with a likelihood that the Book of Mormon is a work of fiction is less than 1 in 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, when you give the Book of Mormon the worst chances, it still comes out looking really good.
Is that 3 or 4 billions, just to clarify?
That is four billion. So 1 in 1,000 billion.
That's pretty great.
Another thing they did in this this sort of sensitivity analysis to basically say, well, what if we got a whole bunch wrong? Is they reduced they pose a question. They said at the ratio of strength of evidence, so how many total correspondences are required to shift our skeptical prior of 1 billion to 1 against the Book of Mormon to 1 billion to 1 in favor of the Book of Mormon? And the answer is about 17 total correspondences. Only 17 out of the 131 correspondences, so about 13% or 1 out of every 8, must be accepted at their assigned evidentiary strengths to shift the strong skeptical prior to a strong positive posterior, or a strong positive conclusion. So basically, if you're going through their list of 131 correspondences and you're like, ah, that's not very strong, that's not very strong, that's not very strong, you can discount what's 131 minus 17? You can discount 113 of them before 114 of them. You can discount 114 of them, and you still are going to end up reversing the initial skepticism of 1 billion to 1 that the Book of Mormon's true to 1 billion to 1 that the Book of Mormon's false. So that's pretty interesting analysis, in my opinion.
Yeah, pretty strong body of evidence. Though a lot of times people just don't think of it in such an organized framework.
Right.
And so don't actually realize how strong it is.
Yeah, and to be clear, for anyone who's listening who might think, oh, but they're only looking at the positive evidence or whatever, they went through and they identified anything that Coe said, like, you know, Michael Coe says, there's no steel in America. So they count that, and they counted up all the things that Michael Coe has said was not in America that are mentioned in the Book of Mormon as well. And they counted that against the Book of Mormon and did similar statistical analysis there and factored that in. And the outcome is still that there just wasn't enough negative correspondences to outweigh all of this positive evidence is basically the summary of that.
I'd be interested to see what sort of reception this gets in the larger world.
Yes, yes.
How, for example, it's Reddit peer review goes.
Well, I don't know about you, but I implicitly trust the anonymous scholars and experts on Reddit. I mean, they have shower thoughts, man. That's got to count for something, you know.
For sure. No, I'm very interested to see how the reaction is to this, and because, like I said at the beginning, this is actually a very bold paper. It's making some very bold conclusions, and it's coming out swinging in a lot of ways, and it's going right at Dr. Michael Coe for the statements he's made about the Book of Mormon, and just almost taunting him by saying we're not even going to consider anything any evidence that comes in anybody else's work. We're just going to look at what you've said about the Maya themselves and compare that to the Book of Mormon. So it'll be very interesting. I'm curious to see the results that. As somewhat of a bystander in terms of this statistical analysis, I'll be curious to see what other people have to say who are more informed on that matter.
Yeah, I think that this certainly has opened up a new line of inquiry and conversation like you said, Neil, it's sort of a new, bold kind of thing. One of the marks of scholarship is having something innovative that brings something new to the table, and I think that this paper does that. I can't speak to its soundness because I'm not a statistician, but it looks, I mean, it looks fairly rigorous from what I could see, and I think it deserves a careful, nuanced response from other statisticians to discuss, and other scholars,
absolutely,
of course, to discuss what's going on here.
Yeah, definitely. So if you're interested, go check it out. Joseph Smith, the world's greatest guesser at the Interpreter Foundation website. And we will be right back after this break. This is the Interpreter Show. Welcome back to the Interpreter Show. I'm your host, Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio with by Jasmine and Jasmine Rapley and Stephen Smoot. And we have joining us by phone, Hale Swift. One of our sponsors here is Cruise Lady. And have you ever dreamed of a trip to the Holy Land or to Book of Mormon lands? Now is the time. Experience an unforgettable, relaxing getaway on a cruise ship or an escorted land tour with Cruise Lady, the best in tours for Latter-day Saints. For example, join a Cruise Lady cruise featuring likely Book of Mormon lands starting at $569 with Professor Jack Welch in December this year. Or join a tour of the Holy Land this May with Interpreter's own Professor Dan Peterson as your guide. Or let Professor Robert Millett guide your tour of church history sites this September. For details, contact Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. That's 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. So we just wrapped up a discussion of the latest paper published in Interpreter, and as we know, everyone this year for gospel doctrine class is studying in the New Testament, and we're going to get to a discussion about a Come Follow Me lesson in a few minutes. But before we go there, there was actually a new publication that may interest Latter-day Saints studying the New Testament this year. And Jasmine, would you like to maybe tell us a little bit about that this new volume that just came out?
I would love to. The title of the volume is called New Testament History, Culture, and Society, A Background to the Texts of the New Testament, edited by Lincoln Blumel. And this volume is monumental on multiple fronts. It's a huge 400-some page book full of detailed chapters by the best LDS contributors we have on the New Testament. I mean, they got pretty much anyone who has said anything significant with a relevant degree on the New Testament is in this volume, and it is rigorous, it is exciting, it is grand. I mean, they have contributors such as Catherine Taylor, Gay Strather, Julie Smith, Eric Huntsman, Jared Ludlow, John Welch, John Gee, Alan Farnes, Andrew Skinner, Bob Millett, Andrew Smith. I mean, I could just go on and on and on. Everyone, I mean, all of the LDS Avengers are assembled in this volume. They have just pulled out
all
the
Thanos of this of this series here. Is it Satan? Or
yeah, that would be Satan would be Thanos.
And it's on a variety of topics. I mean, it's not going to be a verse-by-verse commentary like what the BYU New Testament Commentary Series is doing. This is going to be more of an anthology that gathers together different chapters on generic topics with the New Testament, such as Jesus and the Gospels, the Greco-Roman background of the New Testament, the Jewish background of the New Testament, textual criticism in the Book of Mormon, general essays on the epistles, the Apostle Paul, and some things that happen after the New Testament, such as the development of Christianity. And so if, you know, you were ever wanting to get into studying the New Testament and you wanted a one-stop shop to go to, this is definitely it. Now, I haven't read any of the chapters myself yet. I've only held the book and flipped through the table of contents, but I'm really excited to dig in. Have either any of you guys had a chance to read any of the papers within?
I have, yes. I've taken a look at some of them. One of them I read was John Gee's chapter, The Cares of This World, Roman Economics and the New Testament. there are several references in the New Testament to economic interaction and exchange happening. It mentions specific kinds of economic players, like certain bureaucrats, tax collectors, that sort of thing. It also mentions like certain coins and forms of currency that were in circulation. And so John Gee just provides some background to what the economic world looked like mm-hmm. in the time of Jesus. We actually have a number of surviving papyri from Egypt and Palestine and other parts of the Mediterranean world that can give us a sort of a snapshot of what, like, for example, how much certain grain cost
right.
And what the exchange rates for certain economic professions and things like that. So it's important to understand this. It may seem really dry and unnecessary to some people, but it's important to understand precisely to get a proper cultural background or understanding of some of the things happening in the New Testament. So we talked last month. We talked about the parable of the talents, or no? It's the parable of the unjust. Come on, what am I thinking of?
The one where the
forgiveness of the other guy.
Yeah. So I was thinking I had like five parables running through my brain there.
Okay,
yeah.
But the point being, there's a lot of parables that deal with monetary value.
Yeah, like the guy that, you know, he says you owe me like 2 denarii worth of stuff, and the other guy owes him like $1 billion or whatever. You know what I'm talking about. Go back and look at
the other. We often like talk about the parable of the talents, for example, in primary, and talk about, well, have you learned to sew? Have you learned to play the piano? How are you developing your talents? Not really equating it with like a monetary value.
Monetary value, right, precisely. So John Gee's article I found very informative. And as is John Gee's style, he's very meticulous with documenting from the primary sources. The papyri we have survived. One little insight, for example, that I found rather phenomenal, rather remarkable, is after Rome conquered Egypt, Caesar Augustus essentially depleted Egypt of all of its wealth. And it went towards, practically all of its wealth. I think the equivalent was like several billions of dollars in modern monetary value. It was some ludicrously high number that he emptied Egypt. Well, because, you know, he conquered the Ptolemies and he emptied their coffers basically and put it all towards the expansion of the empire. And that had economic problems for Egypt and so forth. So, like, interesting stuff like that. The other one that I read off the top of my head was chapter 37 by Tom Waymont, Textual Criticism and the New Testament. Tom Waymont was one of my professors at BYU. I think, Jasmine, you had a classroom
had
as well,
classroom
if I recall.
Too.
Great professor.
Went to Italy with him on a trip.
That's right. Yeah, you went with him on a trip. So he's a great scholar, and he's done a lot of textual history on both the Greek New Testament and the King James Bible specifically. And he discusses where the textual criticism of the King James Bible has raised some questions that we as Latter-day Saints have to grapple with, because we have unique scripture in the Restoration that a textual criticism of the King James Bible raises questions. So, for example, the ending of the Gospel of Mark. Tom Waymont discusses the fact that there's almost near universal scholarly consensus that the current ending of the Gospel of Mark, as you have in your King James Bible, was not original to Mark's Gospel. That in the original ending, it ends right when the women run away from the tomb because they're scared because they see the angel, right?
Right.
And it just kind of leaves on this cliffhanger, and so later scribes sort of cobbled together an alternative ending for it. Well, the problem is the Book of Mormon quotes the long ending of Mark almost verbatim.
And Jesus, when he comes in 3rd Nephi.
Yeah, he delivers the same kind of charge that he gives to the apostles at the end of Mark, right? So how do we deal with that? How do we discuss this? Also, he looks at the Joseph Smith translation. So if you look at how Joseph Smith retranslates, quote-unquote, retranslates the Lord's Prayer in the Gospel of Matthew versus the Gospel of Luke, he's not necessarily consistent with the kinds of changes he's making and how that stacks up with a critical reading of the Greek text, right? So Tom Waymont says, can we really classify this particular instance as a translation in the conventional sense? Well, probably not. There's something else happening here. So we have to ask these sorts of questions. And it's nothing that – and Tom Waymont's very clear to say, I'm not trying to threaten or challenge faith. I'm just trying to raise these real concerns that scholars have raised and encourage us to approach it from a specific Latter-day Saint perspective and not just sort of ignore it or dance around it. So I found it appropriate. I found it judicious. I think that these are legitimate questions to raise and that we should be exploring. And this will hopefully give sort of more casual Latter-day Saint readers and educators a sense of what's out there to help their students and help navigate the issues.
I really like Tom Wayman's discussion on Joseph Smith translation and exploring the very broad ways that Joseph sometimes used that word and how translation can mean all sorts of things, and particularly in connection with this issue of textual criticism, because, the translation, a typical translation requires, opening up a lexicon and converting one word from another, saying, okay, Greek metanoio, English repentance. Mm-hmm. But Joseph Smith often was expanding. He was receiving additional revelation. He was, translation was a very broad thing for him. And so I think it helps Latter-day Saints make sense of, for example, the eighth article of faith, that we believe the Bible to be the word of God as far as it is translated correctly. And, if we were to take translated as the narrow academic term, well, that's kind of simplifying the transmission of the New Testament and Old Testament texts altogether. I mean, we're talking about not just translation, but transmission and scribal glosses and all sorts of stuff when we're trying to talk about preserving what the Bible originally said, or maybe originally was intended to say, but never actually got written.
And that can also include interpretation, since every translation by nature is an interpretation. And one of the major changes Joseph Smith makes in the, well, I like to call it what he calls it. He called it the New Translation. We call it the JST. One of the major changes he makes in the New Translation is he updates the archaic English language of the KJV.
Right.
In fact, he does that in the very passage Wayman discusses. So it's in the KJV, Our Father, which art in heaven. That's archaic. So Joseph changes it to Our Father who is in heaven, right? Like he changes the pronouns to update it. So these sorts of, as you said, Jasmine, these sorts of considerations have to be taken in mind when we discuss what the JST is, and nuance it a little bit more. And so I think it's appropriate that Wayman did that.
Hales, did you have something to say earlier?
Oh, well, a few things. One was, just so we don't leave Stephen's cliffhanger hanging too far off the cliff, the Mark ending isn't necessarily problematic as long as we understand it as an authentic saying of Jesus, whether or not it was originally included in that place in Mark. Because if indeed it is an authentic saying of Jesus, there's no reason to suppose Jesus might not repeat himself, as is the case.
Right.
That we see in both the Gospels and in the Book of Mormon. The other comment or question I had is, if indeed we see Satan as the Thanos of this book, then does he get cast out of heaven within the first 15 minutes of the War in Heaven?
Well, man, spoiler alert.
Yeah, man, wow, okay. The real question is, who's the Iron Man then?
Yeah, that's right.
I would just like to maybe add a couple of things. People might be interested to know that in addition to what some of these drier-sounding, archaic things that, as Stephen stressed, are important because they provide background and you understand the economics of the parables, for instance, better if you just know what's going on economically in the New Testament world. There are some papers on topics that you might traditionally expect. There is a paper on baptism in the New Testament, for instance, ritual worship and ritual practices in the New Testament. There's a paper on the atonement, the crucifixion and the resurrection. That's three separate papers, one on each of those things. So the kinds of, there's a lot of things. There's papers that give you background on specific gospels or specific epistles.
Women in the New Testament.
Women in the
Family
New Testament.
Family and marriage in the New Testament world.
So maybe what we should discuss, we've got maybe a few more minutes on this, is what makes this particular volume such a landmark in New Testament studies for Latter-day Saints?
Well, one thing is that Latter-day Saints in general have been treading a little light on the New Testament. The BYU New Testament commentary in a lot of ways is a huge step forward because it's the first time we're trying to do a multi-volume commentary. And now this volume is really the first really rigorous cultural anthology. I know we've done Jesus Christ in the World of the New Testament before. We've done the Life and Teachings of Jesus Christ as well. And those were kind of first steps. But I think this is kind of the magnum opus of all of that, compiling all the guns to comment on their specific expertise on the New Testament and how it helps Latter-day Saints understand their scriptures better.
Right.
I would say from my perspective, this book is what the Bible Dictionary should be, if I can just say that rather plainly. Look, there's a lot of great stuff for the Bible Dictionary. I don't want to knock it too much, but there's also a lot of problems with it. It's an outdated dictionary. It's an outdated reference in many regards. So this is a very nice addition to that for average Latter-day Saints.
Excellent. So that is our break coming up. When we return, we will discuss Come Follow Me. But this has been The Interpreter Show.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, welcome back to The Interpreter Show. I am your host, Neil Rapley. I am joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley and Stephen Smoot. And joining us by phone is Hales Swift. We are getting into the Come Follow Me portion of our show today, and today we will be discussing the lesson scheduled for the week of May 20th through the 26th, Behold Thy King Cometh, and it covers, it feels like there's a lot of material in this lesson, because it covers Matthew 21 through 23, Mark 11, Luke 19 and 20, and John 12. So, you know, if you're trying to keep up with the reading, you're maybe scratching your head a little bit there. Like, there's some weeks you only have one chapter to read, and now you've got so many for this one. You've got, like, seven. You've got seven chapters this week. So that's a lot of reading. It feels overwhelming. If you're a gospel doctrine teacher, this might feel like a lot of material to cover. So it maybe helps to recognize that this is actually there's a lot of overlap between this material. This is mostly covering just what happened on Palm Sunday. If that feels familiar, it's because we did actually also just recently cover Holy Week on Easter Sunday as well. So the material covered in this lesson is the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, which shows up in all four accounts, and that's a good chunk of your reading across the four Gospels there. There's Jesus' lament over Jerusalem. There is his cleansing of the temple. And then there's some teachings of Jesus there at the temple, as well as confrontation with the Pharisees and the scribes a little bit. And he has some woes for them, and they try to stump him with some questions, and are, you know, he always has a great answer and response back. So that's kind of the gist of the material that you're going to be covering here. It's a lot of cool stuff. Maybe I hope that makes you feel a little less overwhelmed by the amount of chapters covered here. But why don't we go ahead and start with the triumphal entry and maybe start talking a little bit about that. Maybe why is this covered in all four Gospels, one of the few things that does get that kind of coverage? And what are maybe some of the different ways the gospel authors present this material?
Yeah, that probably sounds good. I guess we'll just jump in and sort of frame things a little bit. I think the most apparent reason why all four gospels include a description of the triumphal entry is because it clearly demarcates, more or less the last week of the Savior's mortal life.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of setting up that narrative of the chain of events that led to his death, crucifixion, resurrection, and so forth. And it kind of all starts here with the triumphal entry. To go off of Hale's co-opting of the Avengers imagery, it sets up the end game for Jesus. Sorry, was that too soon? It's setting up what you're about to read. It's setting up the climax of the gospel narratives of the life of Jesus. And it's important because this is also where you have sort of the most, if you can say, the most overt manifestation of Jesus' messianism, right? His kingship, or what you might say, right? Because this is where the people effectively proclaim him king for the first time,
right?
Publicly, at least, if I'm not mistaken. Whereas people, sort of en masse too, they confirm him, at least his followers confirm him as king of the Jews, right? they quote this prophetic, or rather messianic language from Zechariah, talking about, tell the daughter of Zion, behold, your king comes, meek and riding a donkey, a colt that is in the foal of a donkey. That's Matthew 21, verse 5. Right. So there's, and then also going in verse 9, and the crowds that went before him and his followers cried out, saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord, Hosanna on the highest. Son of David, the king on the donkey. I mean, it's very overt here. Mm-hmm. So, this, yeah, I think that's probably why all four mentioned this. It's a significant, it's like the baptism of Jesus, right? It's such a significant milepost for his earthly ministry that they want to incorporate that into the narrative, the ultimate narrative of their accounts.
Yeah, and I think Jasmine was actually saying something to me earlier today as we were talking about this, about there's a lot of coronation imagery in this account here. And, of course, we know he's headed to Jerusalem because the Passover is coming up, right? And, you know, major festivals like that, the Jews didn't have a king at this point in time, but, you know, it was during these festival seasons in earlier times in the pre-exilic period and stuff is when the Jews would have been coronating their king. There's obviously, well, maybe not obvious to most, but there is some debate historically as to whether that was something that would be happening around the time of the autumn festivals or the spring festivals. But there's even some imagery bringing in autumn festivals, I think you were saying. Some imagery from Sukkot and stuff like that in the
account. Right, the palm fronds. Well, John is the only account that specifically mentions palm fronds, but they're talking about waving branches.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that you would do during Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles, where you're commemorating the journeying in the wilderness for 40 years.
Right.
The other thing that's interesting is First Maccabees 13 records the fact that when the Jews had defeated Antiochus IV, defeated the Greek Seleucids, after they retook Jerusalem, they waved palm branches, among other things, to commemorate their retaking of Jerusalem. So this would have been pretty in your face.
A pretty overt political statement
to be waving palm fronds.
In addition to that, I mean, processions, giant celebratory processions, aren't unprecedented when Jesus does it. It's something that happens whenever a conqueror comes and he conquers your territory. He's going to have a formal procession through your town where everyone's, you know, hail the new ruler. He's the new guy in town. Or when there's a new coronation of a king, or whenever there's a dignitary visiting and they want to, you know, impress him, they'll have a nice procession for him to bring him into the downtown, if you will. And so, yeah, it would have been a big deal. In fact, I was talking to my father about this, who's from Argentina, and he, you know, comically and a little bit satirically was commenting about thinking about how Palm Sunday would have been with the crowds and the yelling and the cheering for this new king. He's like, oh, it's kind of like after the World Cup in 1978 when Argentina won and Maradona, their key soccer player, you know, had a procession through the city of Buenos Aires, and the whole city was mad and excited. I'm like, well, yeah, kind of.
I mean, yeah, it's that's not too far off, and you know, it happens in America too. Whenever you know, I'm an NBA fan, I follow basketball most, so you know, anytime the Warriors of late have been winning a lot of NBA championships, Oakland has a big parade. And you know, the players, you know, kind of strut down the street and all that kind of stuff. Hopefully that doesn't come across as too crass
or flippant. Yeah, we don't want to get that impression.
There's obviously a sacred nature to this for these people. They believed their Messiah had come, their king, their savior, their anointed one.
And one of the things that I had wondered while studying these accounts was, you know, where did all these people come from? I mean, it seems like, yeah, Jesus is a big deal, but, you know, did he really have enough followers to, you know, rile up a whole city? And some people would suggest that a lot of these followers are coming from Galilee, since that's where a lot of his base is. John, interestingly, adds another detail where he suggests that all these followers are coming as a result of the fact that he just raised a man from the dead 2 days before, and it was just mind-blowing, and many people believed him after that event.
Right.
And so that when they heard that he was coming into the city, they said, oh my gosh, let's celebrate. Let's make a big deal.
I think that's very likely, and I think in any case, the timing of this is crucial. as we've mentioned, this is Passover. This is a huge festival. And if Jesus is ever going to be in your face about his kingship or let his followers do that, it's
right.
going to be when there's a lot of followers around
yeah,
that will be able
true.
To will be able to keep him safe. You know, when I read this, I wonder why on earth the Romans didn't immediately swoop down and arrest him or something. And I think it may be something to say the fact that it would have incited an absolute riot if
right.
they had immediately come in to stamp this out. So I think there's something strategic going on here, why he chose this time to sort of make this, because he even says, right, go in advance and get the donkey and let's prepare a thing. So I think there's that may also explain the timing of why it happens here.
Yeah, and as far as where all these people come from, actually, I've been reading a book by Shimon Gibson, who is an archaeologist, and he's been, I'm not even 100% sure what his religious background is. It sounds like he's an Israeli, though, based on his name. Excuse me. But he has this book on the final days of Jesus, the archaeology behind it and stuff. And in one of his chapters, he talks about Jesus' approach to Jerusalem and specifically talks about how he appears to have started and gone through the region where John the Baptist had his major following as he's making his approach and is gathering the crowds as he makes his way. And yeah, he mentions the raising of Lazarus from the dead as kind of being a part of this recruitment, if you will. And note that a little later in this section, when you get the Pharisees and whatnot questioning Jesus, they ask a question about they ask him a question, and then he asks them a question back where he says, well, what do you say about the authority of John? And they're all really afraid. They're like, well, we don't want to say anything that's going to upset the people about this, because they know all the people there are devotees of John. And so he seems to have kind of brought John's following with him into the city. And so that's maybe a part of where a lot of these people are coming from.
On some of the other kingly imagery, we know that Jesus Christ comes in riding on a donkey and that people are putting clothes down in front of him to pave the way, if you will, roll out the red carpet with their tunics. And we have precedent for that, specifically the colt. We know that Solomon at one point entered into Jerusalem on a donkey. Not a colt. And we find that in 1 Kings. And then the clothing that they lay out on the way for Jesus is... We also find that in 1 Kings, and it's about Jehu. The king Jehu, when he comes back to the city, they spread out clothes for him. So that's kind of the precedent for where we see some of that kingly imagery coming. And we also notice that in Matthew specifically, Jesus says, you know, find a donkey and a colt. But in some of the other Gospels, it's just a donkey. Was there two? Was there one? Maybe we can just, you know, cover that real quick. Is there two?
It's a little confusing in Matthew because it says that he rode on both of them too. And I'm trying to imagine, how do you ride on a colt and a donkey at the same time? I think though, what's kind of going
Water
on here
style.
is, you know, they say that this is for fulfilling the prophecy in Zechariah
9. Yeah.
And Zechariah is actually... referring to in Zechariah 9:9, the donkey and colt is a parallelism, a poetic parallelism.
Right.
It's really referring to the same animal,
single animal.
Twice. And so then the other accounts only mention one. And so I think it's probably just one. The author of Matthew is just trying to account for both, kind of thing.
Yeah, it seems Matthew may have been confused based on a misreading of the prophecy in Zechariah.
Right.
And the King James follows the Greek reading. So just looking at it, it looks like the Greek has this conjunction upon a donkey, kai epipolon, and also on a colt, right? So... And I haven't checked. I'd imagine that's the Septuagint reading of Zechariah, and that's
right.
where Matthew, the author of Matthew, is getting it from. And so with this misreading that scholars think may go back to actually the author of Matthew himself, you suddenly have two animals, whereas in the other Gospels, it's only the one animal.
Right.
Interestingly, that the JST actually deletes the reference to two animals and has him riding on just one animal as well.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of interesting.
Perceptive or perhaps inspired.
Yeah, correction by
correction
Joseph
by Joseph Smith.
Smith. Which, by the way, goes back to earlier discussion of what the JST is and isn't, right?
Right.
Because you can fairly literally render the Greek like the King James Bible does, but that can confuse people. So
right.
Joseph Smith sort of clarifies this. In any event, yeah, that's kind of this leads us to be a little more careful or a little more aware of how New Testament writers were quoting and utilizing Old Testament scripture. And it's not always just a simple case of, oh, the Old Testament just clearly and unambiguously prophesied of Jesus coming. There were prophetic promises of the coming of Christ, but early Christian writers, including the gospel writers, had to sort of grapple and interpret the significance
right.
of these prophecies
yeah.
and construct a narrative around them. And sometimes mm-hmm. they fudged on some of the details because they weren't always clear. So we just have to sometimes appreciate that.
Right. Does anyone else have anything on the triumphal entry before we maybe move on to the cleansing of the temple?
Well, that's
actually,
it.
Before we move on
break.
To a commercial break, we will be right back, and we will be discussing the material on the cleansing the temple at that point. This has been the Interpreter Show. Welcome back to the Interpreter Show. We have been discussing the Come Follow Me lesson for May 20th through 26th. Before we move on, we'd just like to remind you that one of our sponsors is Cruise Lady. Have you dreamed of a trip to the Holy Land or to Book of Mormon lands? Now is the time. Experience an unforgettable, relaxing getaway on a cruise ship or an escorted land tour with Cruise Lady, the best in tours for Latter-day Saints. For example, join a Cruise Lady cruise featuring likely Book of Mormon lands starting at $569 with Professor Jack Welch in December this year. Or join a tour of the Holy Land this May. That's coming up really soon, or right now maybe, with Interpreter's own Professor Dan Peterson as your guide. Or let Professor Robert Millett guide your tour of church history sites this September. For details, contact Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. That's 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. Now, as I said, we have been discussing the gospel, the Come Follow Me lesson for May 20th through the 26th. This covers basically Palm Sunday. We've been discussing the triumphal entry, after that entry, we have the cleansing of the temple. I think, Stephen, did you have something, some comments on that aspect of it all?
I did, yes. So just like the triumphal entry, the cleansing of the temple is recorded in all four Gospels. And I think the reason for that being, just as the triumphal entry is setting up the final episode of Jesus' life, the cleansing of the temple is arguably the incident that leads to Jesus dying, to leads to his death. It's arguably the thing that really galvanizes his enemies to take actions to conspire to kill him.
In the Synoptic Gospels,
well,
Matthew,
yes.
Mark, and Luke.
Yes. But in any event, it is a very important incident, and the basic account is that Jesus goes into the temple, and it says he throws out the sellers and the buyers in the temple, sometimes translated, well, and then he overturns the table of the money changers and the seats of the dove sellers. This is from Matthew's gospel. And he says to them, "It is written, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers." He's quoting the Old Testament there, Jeremiah, I believe. People start to lose their minds over this, not the least being his opponents, who get upset, understandably, but even people just sort of come around to see what's all the ruckus here.
Right.
And, this is loaded with, importance here,
mm-hmm.
this short little section. I don't know if anybody else wants to say before. I don't just want to ramble on here. I don't know if anyone else has any thoughts to sort of set up this episode or... Any comments in that regard?
No.
Okay, I'll continue rambling then.
ramble on.
so I'll start with sort of a joke with what I think. So what we're actually getting at here. So when I was growing up in Salt Lake City, and we would have mutual night, and We would go down to the Salt Lake Temple to do baptisms for the dead. We would rent out the clothes there.
Mm-hmm.
And they sell you clothing. They'll sell you. You can rent clothing for a very, very low fee, a cleaning
very
fee,
affordable price, yeah.
Like 50 cents or whatever.
Right.
And my friend and I, we had a longstanding joke that we would tell each other as we were getting our clothes, which was to say, when you get temple clothing, you have to have exact change. Why? Because Jesus doesn't like money changers, right? Like, so you're not supposed to make change in the temple, right? And we just sort of would laugh at ourselves for our stupid joke. But people have taken, many have taken the cleansing of the temple as to say that Jesus was somehow condemning all sorts of commodification and commercialization.
Right.
They take it sort of a blanket condemnation that Jesus was overturning any kind of commercialization or commercial activity. That, I think, is a very wide overreach and a misreading of this passage. So it's important to get a little context with who these money changers are at the temple and why Jesus would be upset with them.
Uh-huh.
And these are the people, basically, in a nutshell, if you're coming down, if you're from Galilee and you have to sacrifice your animal, like you have a sheep, let's say, and the sheep gets nicked in the arm or the leg by a wolf on the way down, let's say, well, you can no longer sacrifice that sheep because now it's been blemished. It's
right.
been injured.
Yeah.
So what, or let's say you don't want to like haul the sheep all the way down with you or whatever. So what you can do is you can go to a local seller, a local moneylender or,
uh-huh.
or money changer, and you can pay, you can pay the temple tax that you're obliged to pay as an Israelite. But you can exchange your money there. You can also purchase animals there. You can essentially avoid the hassle of bringing animals with you by buying them there on the side of the temple or changing your money. So you might you can't be donating Greek denarii or Roman currency to the temple. You have to have Israelite currency, shekels, right?
Right.
Okay, so what's the problem with that, right? People want to get their animals there at the site. They don't want to change their money. What's the problem? Well, the problem seems to be what you would call sort of predatory lending or other exploitative practices,
right.
Where the people who were lending the money could either extort you or they could charge exorbitant amounts of interest or take advantage of you in other ways to their own gain, to their own benefit.
Right.
One thing that scholars have pointed out that when the Jews revolted in, 66 AD, when they revolted against Rome and the revolutionary stormed the Temple Mount, one of the first things they did, and this is recorded in Josephus, they burned the books of the temple treasury.
Uh-huh.
They burned and they destroyed all the records of people who had loans or debts to the temple treasury, right? Mm. So there seems to have been some serious grievance with corruption amongst the temple bureaucracy that were overseeing the books, right? This seems to be what Jesus was really upset about.
Right.
It's not just that they were commodifying religion or something. It's specifically there seems to have been some unethical shenanigans going on by the temple bureaucracy, and he's saying that you have corrupted the temple to such an inextricable, almost irredeemable degree that this warrants the action he takes. The other thing I'll just say, and then I'll pass the mic here, is N.T. Wright, the famous Anglican New Testament scholar, has pointed out this seems to be in the Synoptic Gospels, at least, Jesus is sort of foretelling, or the Gospels are foretelling, the eventual destruction of the temple itself. In other words, Jesus is making inoperative for an hour or two, and they
uh-huh.
set up the temples or the tables again.
But
right. he's making inoperative an important part of the temple economy, as it were. This may be sort of a narrative foreshadowing of the fact that down the road, as Jesus predicted, right? Oh, it's well, not necessarily, but as later does happen, the temple is destroyed itself. So there's that consideration as well to
right.
think about what this may signify.
Yeah, just to go on your point of the potential extortion going on, I think you get a hint of that in, I think it's Matthew's account that mentions that he's not only just turning over the tables and he's also turning over the cages of the doves. He doesn't mention lambs or rams or goats,
right.
and the doves are the sacrifice that would have been used for the poorer class of
yeah.
society. And so you get the sense that they're taking advantage specifically of the poor by maybe
yeah.
overcharging on doves specifically. And it brings a lot of weight to his declaration that you have turned my father's house into a den of thieves. You are being dishonest in
right.
the way you're exchanging this money.
Yeah. And, you know, there's also maybe a little part of it, at least, that, you know, if you have a lamb at home that you could bring to sacrifice, but you're like, oh, I'll just buy another one at the temple. Maybe it's kind of cheapening the sacrifice because you're not really willing to take one from your own flock and sacrifice that and lose that commodity, if you will. You would rather just buy an animal at the temple for the purpose of sacrifice. It's like it maybe kind of just cheapens it. You're not really sacrificing something of yours in that sense. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's an interesting thought, yeah.
And, of course, a lot of the reasons for providing animal services, if you will, at the temple is because so many of these people are coming from very far distances. I mean, they're not going to be bringing their herds with them. They're just, you know, traveling, staying in the city for the Passover and going to be heading out. So it's much easier to have, you know, rent your clothing at the temple, to use
right,
that analogy,
right.
as opposed to bring it in your suitcase.
But yeah, I don't know, unless there's something else, we can maybe move on. I know Hales had something he wanted to share on the fig tree.
Well, before we move on, I do think both Stephen and I have some things to talk about. But I mean, it's such a drastically different portrayal of Jesus that you see in this episode than you see in many other instances, and especially the Gospel of Luke, where he's a nice Jesus, he's a kind Jesus, he's a compassionate Jesus. And here we see a Jesus who's not pulling any punches. And it's refreshing to see in some ways, and it makes you reconsider your idea of who Jesus of Nazareth was and what makes him a God, what makes him prophet, what makes him the Son of God, what makes him our Savior and our Redeemer. And part of it is, you know, a dividing of the wheat and the tares, of determining what is right, what is wrong, and there are definitive lines. I know prophets in recent years have talked about moral relativism, and it is becoming more common to tolerate any sort of behavior at all, and that tolerance is the ultimate virtue in today's secular society. But Jesus does tend to draw lines where he knows that things are moral and amoral, and he draws those lines and demands that we follow him.
Yeah, good thoughts there, Jasmine. I think the other thing I just wanted to mention, I think it's worth mentioning, is the difference of the accounts in the Gospel of John versus the Synoptic Gospels. So in the Synoptic Gospels, the cleansing of the temple happens at the end of Jesus' ministry, whereas in the Gospel of John, it happens, it seems, towards the beginning.
Right.
That's
how
it's portrayed in John. The other thing that John does is he greatly expands on what happened. So for instance, I believe it's only in John where it mentions that he made the whip and that he chases the guys out with the whip. That's only in John.
Right.
Also only in John is where Jesus much more extensively quotes different scriptures condemning the people there. He doesn't just quote the Jeremiah quote about being a den of thieves. He quotes other things as well, and he has this whole sort of diatribe, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting from a Latter-day Saint perspective, since we have, for instance, different accounts of the first vision.
Right.
Which people sometimes make a big deal about. Well, Joseph Smith gave a fuller account in later years and earlier years. Well, what do you know? We have the same thing happening in the New Testament Gospels.
Sure.
So it's something to be aware of, that this happens more often than not, where, again, it doesn't negate the reality of what happened. I think it's pretty universal. New Testament scholars think that Jesus at some point really did cleanse the temple.
Right, yeah.
But we just have to appreciate that our historical sources may at times not fully harmonize. And
right.
That's okay. We don't have to come up with silly shenanigans to explain, well, maybe there were two times he did it, one before and one after. It's okay. We can just say maybe John got the chronology wrong, right? Like, we're not infallible in that sense. So.
Right.
And to that point, there are very varying opinions on, you know, which one is really the correct cleansing of the temple, the one in John, which comes at the beginning of his ministry, versus the synoptics, which have it in his final week. One person that I think is Mark Goodacre, who provides evidence for maybe the likelihood that John gets it right, is the fact that in the Synoptics, Jesus only visits Jerusalem once in his life. However, as a faithful Jew, you know, it would have been likely that he would have visited for many of the pilgrimage festivals, and John does portray that. And so, you know, John maybe isn't completely discarding real chronology and only focusing on theological thrust of his message. There may be some historicity to the order in which he puts events, but you know, in the end, we'll probably never know.
Right, and we just need to be appreciative of that. That's just sort of, I think, the point here to take away. But Hales, did you have something to say?
On that point, just that it's not unheard of to have conflicting accounts of a riot.
Right.
Right? And this is basically a small little riot. They're
One-man riot, if you will.
Yeah, I like how we call it the cleansing of the temple. It's more of like the ransacking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
But no, that's actually a very good point. And often with when it comes to riots and things like that, not only will you have multiple accounts, but you usually have competing narratives going on at play as different sides want to tell their story. And I'm sure in Jerusalem at the time, after it happened, there was absolutely other, you know, there was the ransacking sort of narrative that was probably going around. And I think was it this that you guys were mentioning during the break? The Synoptic Gospels connect this quite directly to his crucifixion.
Yeah, yeah.
That this is the thing that kind of pushes the Pharisees over the edge, and they get together and say, okay, we've got to do something about this.
From this day forward, they plotted on how they could kill
him. Right. And so, you know, there's definitely this alternate narrative where there's like, this guy's a problem, we've got to do something about it. And it's directly because of this incident. But I think with that said, Hales, I think you had something you wanted to share about the cursing of the fig tree, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct, Neil.
All right.
So in Matthew 21:17-21, there is this incident in which Jesus curses a tree. I'll read that real quick so everyone's on the same page. And he left them and went out of the city into Bethany, and he lodged there. Now in the morning as he returned into the city, he hungered. And when he saw a fig tree in the way, he came to it and found nothing thereon but leaves only, and said unto it, let no fruit grow on thee henceforward forever. And presently the fig tree withered away. And when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, how soon is the fig tree withered away? Understandably, this was rather astonishing.
Right.
So, but I think when we see the story, we should be thinking of it in a larger context. And there are several ways in which we should do that. First, we should understand that fig trees normally bring forth fruit, or early fruit, from the previous year's growth,
mm-hmm.
together with their leaves. So a normal good tree that is going to bring forth fruit in a big way later in the season should be bringing forth these early fruits. It's not their full harvest, which is later,
uh-huh.
but the first fruits were missing. And so that's the first thing. And we should also realize that a lot of what Jesus is doing has at least some mild allusion to the situation with the Pharisees, where they're leading and teaching the people, but not actually coming unto him. So it's worth noting that the first fruits of repentance are baptism, and they don't seem to have borne any.
Mm.
And this is going to result in them ultimately not bringing forth fruit, both individually and the people that they're teaching. The second kind of angle that's worth looking at is probably the most famous incident with fig trees in scriptures is Adam and Eve.
All right.
Because they're Nick. Okay.
Let's pick that up when we get back. This has been The Interpreter Show. Welcome back to The Interpreter Show. I'm your host, Neil Rapley. I'm joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley and Stephen Smoot. And on the phone, we have Hales Swift, who just before the break was discussing the barren fig tree that Jesus cursed on his way back into Jerusalem the next day. And you were just about to share something in relation to the fig tree and Adam and Eve as the break interrupted us. Hales?
Yeah, so Jesus curses the fig tree because it's bringing forth leaves but no fruit. And Adam and Eve are, in fact, the first to dress themselves in leaves. And what we should probably learn from this ill-fated tree is that if you want to dress yourself in fig leaves, you better bring forth some fruit.
All right.
And the first fruits of repentance are, of course, baptism. Which the scribes and the Pharisees, who are by now aspiring to kill him, had been neglecting since John first came and ministered, and should have been sufficient to show them the error of their ways. But now, because they have been failing to bring forth these first fruits, now they will also fail to bring forth any fruit. And think it's a good lesson to all of us. Bring forth fruits that are meet for a reason. Otherwise, you will be brought to see your nakedness at the bar of God and not be pleased. So there.
Yeah. No. That is a great insight. Does anybody else have anything in relation to any of that, or?
I don't know if I can say it any better myself. That was great. I love the comparison to Adam and Eve. Never thought about that before.
All right, excellent. Well, then before we transition, just one more reminder for everybody that one of our sponsors is Cruise Lady. Have you dreamed of a trip to the Holy Land or to Book of Mormon lands? Now is the time. Experience an unforgettable, relaxing getaway on a cruise ship or an escorted land tour with Cruise Lady, the best in tours for Latter-day Saints. For example, you can join a Cruise Lady cruise featuring likely Book of Mormon lands starting at $569 with Professor Jack Welch in December this year, or join a tour of the Holy Land this May with Interpreter's own Professor Dan Peterson as your guide, or let Professor Robert Millett guide your tour of church history sites this September. For details, contact Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. That's 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. All right, so we have Jesus coming back into Jerusalem after kind of staying the night in Bethany, which would have been kind of nearby in the countryside around Jerusalem. And he has what we get in Matthew 22 is a series of encounters, if you will, with the Pharisees, the scribes, and the Sadducees. And they're asking him a series of questions to kind of try and stump him or, test his, how well he knows the law or whatever. And with every question, he's kind of seeing through the hypocrisy and cutting through it. But there's this one question that is maybe a little interesting and raises a lot of questions, particularly for Latter-day Saints and the nature of our own doctrine. And so we thought maybe it'd be a good idea to take a minute to talk over that. And that is the question about marriage and the resurrection that the Sadducees posed to Jesus. And this is in Matthew 22, verses 23 to 33, and I'll just kind of provide a brief summary of the interaction there. You have the Sadducees approach him and say, well, Moses said that if someone dies without having children, their wife, their brother is to marry his wife and father descendants for his brother. And so then they kind of give this ridiculous scenario where a woman is married to seven brothers who each, subsequently die. She's married to one man, he dies, so she's married to his brother. He dies, so she's married to his other brother. He dies, married to the next brother, on and on, till the seventh time. And then they, after going through that whole scenario, they kind of pose the question, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? And Jesus' answer is that in the resurrection, you neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels of God in heaven. Of course, fast forward 1800 years, and you have Joseph Smith receiving a revelation explaining that actually there are opportunities to be sealed together forever in the eternities and to be married and to continue your marital relations into the next life. So maybe what do we make of this exchange with Jesus and the Sadducees here in light of Latter-day Saint doctrine?
Well, I think there's an interesting thing going on here. Before we answer that question, which is a good question, I just want to point out Latter-day Saints sometimes look on the rest of the Christian world with incredulity when Christian, sort of Orthodox Christianity says, hey, marriage is a great thing, but it's just an earthly thing. It's not going to last forever. There's mm-hmm. no marriage in heaven.
Right.
We kind of balk at that and sort of think, well, why on earth would you believe that? Well, there's reason why Orthodox Christians believe that.
Right.
We're looking
yeah.
at it right here. And so we have to appreciate that these verses easily lend themselves to that perspective. However, I think, there's a lot of debate on how you could read this. The common view that many scholars have said is that Jesus is envisioning some kind of an androgynous, genderless, marriageless sort of eternity in the kingdom of God, right? That, that these worldly things like marriage and gender constructs, they won't exist, right?
Right.
That's a very prevalent veil that you'll see, or view that you'll see amongst non-Latter-day Saint biblical scholars. However, I think from a Latter-day Saint perspective, and I don't like to do this just sort of authoritatively because it doesn't quite hammer out all the details, but basically we can look to the Doctrine and Covenants to get a restoration perspective on it. So in Doctrine and Covenants, section 132, this section, of course, is dealing with marriage, sealing, plural marriage, keys, I mean, the whole gambit here, right? It actually specifically uses the language from this verse in verse 15 and 16, talking about what happens to people who are married in the world but not by the word of God and not through priesthood sealing keys.
Mm-hmm.
And if it says in verse 16, so it says, if they enter into this marriage without sealing keys, once they are dead, here's the language. Their covenant and their marriage are not of force when they are dead and when they are out of the world. Therefore, they are not bound by any law when they are out of the world. Therefore, when they are out of the world, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are appointed angels in heaven, which angels are ministering spirits, or as I like to jokingly call them, angel butlers, to minister for those who are worthy of a far more and exceeding and eternal weight of glory. So the answer that the Doctrine and Covenants gives is that, yeah, for all intents and purposes, it's as if they aren't married.
Right.
Because their marriage is no longer enforced because it wasn't sealed. So this is the answer that the Lord gives Joseph Smith, at least specifically playing on these verses. And I think from a Latter-day Saint perspective, that's what we turn to say, yeah, we understand that there's debate about how to read this. And you can make the argument that he's talking about a genderless, androgynous marriage or sort of eternity
angels
and afterlife with just angels. Yeah. But we can say, well, if you grant that Joseph Smith had access to Revelation, then this provides a context for how to potentially read these.
Right.
I know some people aren't especially satisfied with that answer, but if you come from a paradigm of faith in the Restoration, then I think that answers it nicely.
Yeah,
and the focus of Jesus' response isn't necessarily on marriage itself, but it is focused on the resurrection because
right.
The irony is that the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection. They have a more finite view of our life's plan. And so Jesus is thinking, you know, what do you even care? You don't believe in the resurrection. And so his response, while touching on marriage, is really focused on the idea that the resurrection's real and I will prove it to you in just a few days.
Yeah. It's also interesting, I will say, that in verse 32, he invokes the language of Exodus chapter 3, verses 6 and 16. He says, concerning the resurrection of the dead, have you not read the word of God to you, saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not a God of the dead, but of the living. Well, that invoking of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is also done in Doctrine and Covenants, section 132.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tied in with this
right.
Very nicely that way. But yeah, I think Jasmine there is right that the point here isn't about whether there's androgynous angel butlers in the afterlife. He's pointing out the absurdity and the insincerity of the Sadducees' challenge, since they don't even believe in the resurrection to begin with.
Right, and I do think it is important to keep in mind, as you yourself explained, Stephen, our doctrine actually has room for there to be, I mean, arguably most marriages throughout history are in fact going to be exactly under this circumstance where marriage was a mortal thing because they were not sealed in the new and everlasting covenant. And so their fate is to be as the angels.
Unless they take advantage of proxy work.
unless they take advantage of proxy work. And I'm a little reticent to bring this up because it's something that gets kind of lampooned a bit online. But there was Joseph Fielding Smith had a teaching that kind of gets...
I think I know where this is going.
He kind of believed that people who did not make it to the celestial kingdom were genderless.
Yeah.
And I won't go into the details that get a little more...
Hashtag TK smoothies for life.
Yeah. This idea that they're genderless and that's reflected in their resurrected bodies is about all I'll say about that.
That's a good way to put it.
But it's actually really interesting. As much as that gets lampooned, you kind of have this precedent in the ancient Christian world, and like you said, that's how a lot of scholars interpret this section from the Gospels and Jesus' teaching, that they're androgynous, they're genderless. They wouldn't have had the ability to marry or be given in marriage because of that. And so there's some actual precedent in even understanding those who don't get sealed in the everlasting covenant within as androgynous angel beings within our own tradition. But one thing that I've always thought is important to keep in mind is the nature of the marriages themselves. These are levirate marriages, which were a provision within the law of Moses specifically for a specific incident and context. And I think it's fair to say, even within a Latter-day Saint tradition, that's not the kind of marriage we would see as an eternal marriage and an eternal scenario. At best, the first brother who was married to her in the first place might have could theoretically be an eternal marriage, but the subsequent marriages are meant to be
substitutes.
Yeah. Substitutes. They're earth only ceilings, if you will.
And one point I do want to.
Yeah, they're not just substitutes. They're a welfare program of sorts.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It serves a very functional purpose in ancient Israel. And one thing I want
to make sure that they're. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. One thing that I want to drive home before we run out of time is that he does say God is not a God of the dead, but of the living. And I think that also ties in the idea of marriage. I mean, yeah, when we're spirits, we're not necessarily interacting in marriage relationships, but the resurrection is the pinnacle and climax of the plan of salvation. And at that point, that is when we become alive in our marriage relationships, in our family relationships. I mean, that's what it's all leading to, the resurrection where we can be with each other as families in the eternities. Did you want to finish your thought, Hales, before we wrap up here?
I forgot what my thought was, but a different thought is that one interesting thing that comes out of this is that man and angels are, in fact, the same set of people, right? And that people can become angels.
Yes, that is a very good point as well. Well, that is it for us on The Interpreter Show, and we hope you enjoyed the show, and have a good night.
When you're hiring, you want qualified candidates fast, and it can be hard to know where to find them.